guys. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin TechNet number 1650 of the series that began back in September of 1982. As you guys have heard so often, the main purpose of the TechNet is to pass information back and forth to each other. The curious radio amateurs gather and share what information they gather as they try to find out more about this magic thing called radio. How does wireless equipment really work? How does that signal propagate 12 billion miles from Voyager spacecraft, three times the distance to Pluto out there, and still talking to us 40 years later, launched in 1977? How does this radio signal do that? It goes everywhere with never completely stopping. It gets weaker and weaker, but it never goes to zero. So you got the right equipment. There's no limit to the distance you can talk to somebody with radio with the right equipment. Let me drop. We'll be listening to Space Report number 250 tonight by Paul WS2N, and we'll be trying to answer people's questions. Last week there was a failure in New York City of portions of the telephone system, so therefore the internet and IRLP connected to this computer was not functioning last week, and I'm pretty sure that has been corrected. Let me check. Yeah, that's been corrected. And so now we should have a bigger audience this week than we did last week. Last week was a little bit light, and I think I ended an hour early last week. Let me drop. Pretty soon I'll be taking check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. And if tonight's a light night, I'll review for you what happened this week with reference to the June issue of QST Magazine, which you can now read online. It probably hasn't been delivered yet. And when it comes to the Doctor is In section by Joel Hallis, I sent him a letter giving him another point of view on the very first question that he answered with reference to standing wave ratio. And I sent that to three of the editors at QST Magazine. I sent it to all three. And I can tell by the answer that I got that there was a misunderstanding. Standing wave ratio, even among people who have been around it for a lot of years, can easily be misunderstood. Let me drop. So we don't have very many questions tonight. I'll review that letter, and I'll show you guys an interesting puzzle with reference to standing wave ratio that is quite controversial, quite puzzling among a lot of amateurs and the well-informed electronic engineers who have worked with RF a lot of years. I'll give you that puzzle, so to speak, and we'll discuss it. So at this time, we're going to take check-ins. You need that check-in because you're listening. If you really do have a question or a comment, you're going to give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means I do have a question or a comment. A typical sign-in would sound like this. If it was Paul, he would be saying WS2N, Paul, and yes. That's the way Paul would be checking in. So if you've got a question or a comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
WB2GXM, Rich, yes.
Okay, we certainly got Rich. Anyone else? Just because of Mother's Day and everybody being so busy, maybe we're going to have a very light night tonight. Anyone to check in with a question or a comment for the TechNet, please give me your call letters and name right now. Hey, Rich, maybe it's only going to be you and me. One last call. Anyone to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
Good evening, Dick.
Paul.
KC2WGB with a question from the mailbag. Only one tonight. Maybe another one will come in. But back to you, Dick.
Very glad to hear from you, John. You're sounding good. Okay. Is there anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name right now. Maybe some people will be checking in later. So, Rich, take your own sweet time. You're number one on the runway. You're the only airplane on this airport. WB2GXM. You can ask us anything, except how to get rich quick with radio. WB2GXM, K2RIW, if you got it, Rich.
W in the group, WGXM. Thank you, Dick. I'm glad to hear you again, John. Glad to hear you sounding good. Okay, so my question tonight is about using oscilloscopes, which I don't have a lot of experience in. I have just read that if you use a benchtop oscilloscope, which uses AC mains as the power source, and you try to measure a circuit which is also connected to the AC mains power source, the difference in ground potentials may damage the scope. So how do I avoid this? Is a differential probe the way to go when measuring an AC powered circuit? And if so, should I always use a differential probe when I'm measuring an AC powered circuit with an AC powered scope? K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM.
Quick comment on that topic, Dick.
Go right ahead, John.
That was my question. It was sent to me in the email. In fact, I got two questions about that this week. Maybe you could explain to him why the differential probe is used, what it does, and how it works. Also, about isolation transformers when working with hot chassis, which is basically what he's speaking about, I believe. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, you've got a darn good question there, Richard. And John, good for some more information on this. A person normally uses a scope probe. It normally has two wires coming out of the front end. One is the grounding clip and the other one's the actual hot lead, so to speak. And if you're going to measure what is the waveform like on your 110-volt line, to put those two leads across the 110-volt line seems logical. And know that if your scope is plugged into the 110-volt line that you're about to measure, you got to be very careful. Because the way that 110-volt line works, 120-volt line, one lead is essentially 0 volts with reference to earth, and the other lead of that wall socket of yours has 120 volts RMS, which reads 167 volts peak, but 120 volts RMS. If you wire the scope probe just the right way, if you're smart enough to know that there's a wide blade and a narrow blade of the plug of your equipment going into the wall, and I think the way it's usually done, if it's wired correctly, the wide blade is the earth lead and the narrow blade is the hot lead. As long as you wire the scope probe correctly, you might get away with it. The safe way to do this, of course, is to have a one-to-one isolation transformer that's used to power the scope.
Correction, Dick?
Now the scope is thoroughly floating. So go ahead, John, on that one.
The wide blade on the socket is the neutral. It's not earth. It's just, you know, just to keep things straight.
Yeah, thank you for the correction, John. Neutral meaning essentially ground, but not necessarily ground. Earth is a round pin. That one is, if wired correctly, is guaranteed to be ground. And that's the round pin. The wide pin is called neutral, and usually is very close to ground. However, you put a sensitoscope across the neutral and ground. In other words, put the scope, put your scope probe clip lead on the one that's called ground, the round pin, and put the other lead on what's called neutral. In many cases, you'll measure a couple of volts there. So it's not really zero. And that couple of volts would be on the chassis of your oscilloscope. If your oscilloscope is wired the normal way, and you take your scope probe and you put the clip lead on so-called neutral and the hot lead of the scope probe on the narrow blade of the of your plug in the wall, you'll measure the 120 volts and you'll see the waveform. But if there's a couple of volts in your particular household wiring between neutral and ground, that's now appearing across the chassis of the scope. The scope, in theory, the chassis of the scope is being grounded by the third lead, the round pin, the grounded pin. That's connected to the chassis of the scope in order to keep it safe for you to touch it and not get electrocuted. But now the scope probe, clip lead, is on neutral, and neutral in some cases is going to have a couple of volts on it. And so now that couple of volts might be backed up with multiple amperes of capability, and now you're putting multiple amperes of current from the clip lead of the scope lead into the scope chassis, and then by
repeater, timeout.
Into the scope chassis, and then by way of the wiring of the plug going into the scope, into the grounded lead. So all kinds of current could be flowing across your scope probe and the chassis of your scope. That's if you've done things just right. If you did it the other way around, if the two leads coming out of your scope probe are used incorrectly, really incorrectly, where you now take the clip lead and put it on the narrow blade, that's the hot lead, even before you connect the scope probe itself to anything else. At that instant of time, you have 120 volts AC flowing across your scope probe, into the chassis, into the plug coming out of the scope that goes into the wall, into that grounded round pin. And you're going to get smoke and flames if that happens. Let me drop. So what's the safe way? If this is the best of all worlds, you own a dual channel oscilloscope, channel A and channel B, and you now use the scope in the A minus B function. In other words, channel A is going to be a scope probe where the hot lead of the scope probe is connected to, let's say, the narrow blade, the hot blade of the 120 volt socket. The scope probe B is going to be connected to the other lead, the broad blade and of your wall socket. And where you put the two grounding clips of the scope probes, connecting them to each other is the right thing to do. Connecting them to earth, the round pin, is probably the right thing to do. Let me drop. And that's because you're using the scope in the A minus B function. In theory, A has got the 120 volts on it, and B has nearly 0 volts, or just the 1 or 2 volts that's on the neutral lead on it. And now you're looking at the real waveform that's going to be presented to your piece of electronics that's plugged into that particular wall socket, the A minus B function. So as long as your scope has two channels to it, an A channel and a B channel, and you can use it in A minus B function, it might not be a dual channel scope, because it's only the A minus B function, only one trace across the screen is required. So as you can tell, this is a hot area of oscilloscope usage. This is a place where lots of errors have occurred. The safest way to do this, if you had the capability, let me drop it, is to have the oscilloscope plugged into a one-to-one isolation transformer, where the primary is connected to the wiring that goes to the plug, that goes to the wall socket, and the secondary of that one-to-one transformer has a socket that you plug the scope into. And now the oscilloscope is thoroughly floating by way of that isolation transformer. In that particular case, one single scope probe hooked up now almost any way you want will work pretty nicely. However, I got to be careful with that one. Even in that particular case, you have to make sure that the clip lead, the alligator clip at the end of the scope probe, goes on to the so-called neutral wire, and that the hot lead goes on to the narrow blade. Because even with an isolation transformer, if you use the scope probe in the wrong way, you can make the scope chassis hot with 120 volts, even though you got an isolation transformer. So you got to go very slow on this one and study what's going on. I bet you've got some words on this one, John, because John has worked with, let me drop it. John, throughout his career, has worked on not only some extremely high voltage 60 cycle landline circuits, but he's also worked on ship power 400 cycle, thousands of amperes, or at least hundreds of amperes, at probably 220 volts and whatever. So my guess is you've seen all kinds of extraneous voltages on so-called neutral wiring, either delta or Y-type wiring. And I bet you've seen numbers of technicians who have used instrumentation improperly connected and either did damage, put themselves at risk, or could create an awful lot of grief. So tell us a couple of those horror stories and some of the step-by-step mistakes that led up to it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNAS.
KC2WGB, oh, absolutely true, Dick. A lot of almost disasters, and some were pretty rough. One of the things you must be careful of, once you've used an isolation transformer, the equipment you're monitoring or measuring is isolated from the line due to the insulation factor between the windings on that isolation transformer. Now, some people make the mistake of confusing the RF ground system and grounding the chassis of the isolated item to earth ground, and they wind up getting all kinds of ground paths and loops. Can be very confusing, and in some cases can cause arc overs and things like that. But yes, I mean, whether you're working on 480 or 48 volts, it's basically all the same. Just take your time and take your volume and do some measurements to make sure you have the proper isolation. You get a couple of volts here and there, drift voltage, that's fine. But when you start seeing 67.5 volts and in that neighborhood, you've got something confused. Something's wrong. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah. Eric recognized, and in the middle of John's last transmission, he said some magic words. Use your volt. Your volt ohm millimeter. Your triplet, your Simpson, that would be more than good enough in this application. Or your digital voltmeter, but a completely floating, battery-operated digital voltmeter. Before you connect that clip lead on the end of your scope lead to the thing that you think is neutral, make sure you measure with your volt ohm millimeter the potential between that clip lead on the scope probe and the thing you're about to connect to. If you see 120 volts difference between the two, stop right there and don't make that connection. If you see something very close to 0 volts or 1 or 2 volts, maybe it's the right thing to do. But to use that volt ohm millimeter to double check is a safe thing to do, because even though you've got a wide blade and a narrow blade on the finger plugs into the wall, on a small number of occasions, the wall socket is miswired, and therefore what you think is safe is not safe. Let's see what Eric's going to say about all of the above. KE2EJ, another guy who works with some pretty high power circuits, and I bet you've seen smokes and flames sometimes when people do things the wrong way. KE2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. Well, I was going to suggest that when you're dealing with stuff like that, including using an isolation transformer, because I've seen isolation transformers where they're not true 100% isolation. If you're working with that kind of stuff, a GFCI socket is really the way to go. And it really doesn't care about voltage. It will trip if there's any sense of, you know, something like 3 or 4 milliamps starts drawing through the ground line. It'll just kill the power going to it. The reality is that if you're working on stuff like this, you're going to be working with an AC circuit that's properly put together. And if you're smart, you put a GFCI socket with your gear. Even if you're using an isolation transformer, it's always a good idea. The GFCI socket will react a lot faster than you will, that's for sure. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Okay, let me ask you this question now, Eric. If your wall socket does not have a ground fault indicator, GFCI, is there a way that you can take a kind of electronics that you can plug into that wall socket and properly ground it, that it can then become a surrogate GFCI? Can a person who doesn't want to take the time to rewire the socket, it doesn't have a GFCI, can he externally create one of those? Is there something I can buy at Walmart or at Home Depot that would help me do that? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Comment.
Yeah, actually, there's a number of things that you can do. But you need a real ground. Don't forget, ground and neutral at some point. Most out circuits are connected together at some point. They sell plugs with GFCIs built in, but you still have to provide a real ground for it to know when it's going to trip. So if you've got just 110 across two blades, and you have no local ground, the only thing that you can do that will make it safe, or make it somewhat safe, is a true 100% isolation transformer. And you got to watch it, because some of them will actually hook the ground pin across, which makes it not a true isolation transformer. There are ways around it, but the wisest thing to do is to have a proper GFCI socket wherever it is that you're working, especially if you're going to be doing this stuff a lot. It'll save you a lot of pain. K2RIW, K2J.
Tim, comment.
Okay, we got two sets of comments lined up. John first, and then the other person. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Yep, everything Eric said is true. Now, Hubble makes a nice little cord length of about 2 feet. There's a 3-pin plug on one end and a GFI adapter at the end. And it's all molded in a nice plastic. It's quite safe and works extremely well. And that will solve the problem. But you must have a good ground pin on that input to that GFI isolator. Back to you, Dick.
On that subject, John, if you don't trust the so-called ground pin, let's say, for instance, you've got a circuit in a house that was wired in the late 50s where the wall socket only has two prongs to it. The third pin is not there. And you want to use this Hubble device that you just described. Where would a person find a reliable ground? If, for instance, the wall socket was wired with BX cabling, with the outer shield of the BX, the steel wrapping, is a quasi-ground, but I don't know if I would trust it. I'll lead over to a...
Good BX cable has a ground wire inside.
Okay. If the BX cable has a ground wire inside, that ground wire inside, when it reaches the socket of this 1955 wall socket that only has two prongs to it, where does that ground lead go, Eric? K2EJ, K2LAW?
Now, in this day and age, you won't find two-pin sockets that have, been recently installed because they're, in essence, illegal. And you'll find houses where the ground pin isn't properly connected either. If you're going to be doing work with this kind of stuff, you've got to guarantee you've got a good ground. And now today, most in the old days, in the 50s and 60s, we always used cold water pipes. You cannot use that anymore. Simply because a lot of replacement, and your pipes get to be 50, 60 years old, and they start to replace them, they replace it with PEX in the ground, and if there's no copper, and there's no real connection to ground. All new electrical installations have to have a minimum 8-foot ground stake at the point of entrance where the power comes into the house. So if you're in a place where there's two sockets, and you'll find some 3-pin sockets, and the 3-pin sockets are connected to the gem box, but the gem box ain't connected to anything. So, you gotta watch it.
So with that PEX-type household water pipes, which are non-metallic, the only real ground you've got is that 8-foot long EIA standard, 5/8 diameter, copper clad or galvanized clad rod in the ground that's at the point of entry that goes to the fuse panel and goes to its local ground, and now you're at a socket at the other end of the house, and this is a 1955 house that has not been rewired, and you're using a two-prong socket. Life is not easy to find a good local ground to operate this Hubble device that John has just described to us. You gotta go slow in a case like that. Maybe you can't make that measurement in that room, if you know what I mean. There's another person who gave us a comment. Who is that? Give us your full set of call letters and your name, sir. And then proceed, K2LIW and SecNet. My name is Dick.
Dick, that comment came from me, WB2GXM Rich. Okay, let me see if I can state this now. The warning article I read was about, specifically, difference in potential between the ground pins of the scope and of the device under test. That would be the round pins. So, let's say that I use the same outlet for both the scope and the device under test. and I create a box using the Hubble device John mentioned, plus an isolation transformer. Does the isolation transformer go to the scope, or can the device under test be on the rig, the isolation transformer? Also, this house is over 80 years old, so I'm going to have to do this in the basement with my nice old metal hot water pipe. Make sure I have the ground. Make sure the ground potential between the two round prongs is zero, etc. K2RWWB2GXM.
Captain, you said your house is 80 years old. Mine was built in 57. So my house is 60 years old. And in the old days, my house had some two-pronged plugs in the wall that hadn't yet been rewired. So something to worry about. Let's see what Eric and John both have to say on Rich's last question on would you use the isolation transformer on the device on the test or on the oscilloscope? And what do you do with who gets grounded to what with the Hubble and so on? And before, the most dangerous part of the whole procedure, in my opinion, is the clip lead that's on the end of the scope probe. Before you're about to touch it to something, my recommendation is you use your volt ohm milliammeter in the AC range and look for any significant amount of voltage between that clip lead and the thing you're about to connect it to. If you see a volt or so, you might be all right. If you see 120 volts, certainly don't proceed, because you're about to create all kinds of grief. I'm going to ask both Eric and John in that order to answer your question as to how he would use the isolation transformer in your particular environment. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Where do I buy the Hubble?
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, there's a couple of different situations. I tend to like to be completely isolated from the line. I like using an isolation transformer and have the chassis of the scope at the same potential as the ground of the device that I'm working on. If I use, say, the scope on the local ground, even though I have an isolation transformer, there's going to be eddy currents that are going to show up. It's not such a cool idea. A number of different people have different mindsets about it. But if I'm going to work on a bench top that is not conductive, I want the isolation transformer and the ground's lifted from it so that the whole thing is floating. That way, the ground clip on my probe is going to be at the same potential as whatever the device is that I'm looking on. If I were to take a volt ohm meter between that and a local ground, there's a possibility that I might see some juice there, which is typical when you're working on something that's a hot chassis and doesn't have an isolation transformer or an input transformer of any kind. It's a tricky little subject, which means that you need to be thoroughly, your workbench, whatever it is that you're working on, has to be isolated, or non-conductive is the best way to go. But different people have different opinions about that. And in certain situations, when you're working with really high power stuff, you have to take a whole different approach to it. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, before I turn this over to John, let me review what I think I heard Eric say. His favorite way to do things is to have a big enough isolation transformer that runs his shop. So he is taking the oscilloscope and the device under test. They're both running from the secondary winding of the isolation transformer, and so that everything he's testing is truly floating. And most of the time, I think that's a very safe way to go. However, inside the oscilloscope, for instance, and if it was a cathode ray tube, old-fashioned type oscilloscope, there might be a 10,000-volt power supply. With your scope thoroughly floating, although it's an extremely rare situation, there is the possibility that you're doing something with the oscilloscope itself, with the cover off, and if the high-voltage lead of the high-voltage power supply of the oscilloscope CRT circuit touches something, it is possible with your whole secondary winding thoroughly floating, that all kinds of crazy voltages could appear on the chassis of that oscilloscope. So when you're working with high voltage, you got to be very careful. Because most of us these days are working with integrated circuits that may be ESD sensitive, electrostatic discharge sensitive. Most of us will operate with a at least mildly conductive bench. In other words, the bench itself has a pad on it that's at least mildly conductive. Less than a megohm, probably 100 K ohm resistance between it and something that's known to be well grounded. With a 100 K resistor between your device on the test and your body in contact with it, you're wearing a wrist strap that's also connected to it. And that wrist strap, by the way, also has something like a half megohm resistor, because if that wrist strap is going to your left arm, left wrist, so to speak, with a half megohm resistor, all's well. If it was a zero ohm resistor to that wrist strap on your left arm, and your right arm managed to touch 110 volts, you can see what would happen. So even with ESD protective circuitry, it will help the situation, but even then you've got to be careful. Let's see what your husband has to say about all of the above. Well, we've made quite a horror story out of this, but you got to go slow. KC2WGB, Mr. Power of here we go. Mr. Power of Staten Island, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, there are many issues involved, and you just have to go slow. Like Eric said, just pay attention, especially if you're up in the levels of 100 or 220 volts. You know, you're working with 48 volts, it's not too bad, but you can do a lot of damage. However, I found another thing that's quite well to do. If I saw what we call a phantom voltage, for some reason we take our volume and we start reading 5 or 10 volts, and we say, okay, is that a real voltage? Because sometimes they can develop just because of stray capacitance or resistive negative coupling, stuff like that. What you do is take like a quarter amp fuse, touch it, and measure that voltage. If it goes away, you're safe. If that fuse blows, you're drawing some current. So that's about the only thing that was left on set, I believe, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
K2J, ever work on hot chassis?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I can think of another way of doing this. Because of the stray capacitance that exists across the primary to secondary winding of your isolation transformer, even though shock-wise the secondary winding makes everything thoroughly floating, but because of the stray capacitance, maybe it's only 20 picofarads, but because of that stray capacitance and the fact that a modern-day digital voltmeter, has an input impedance of 10 megohms. 10 megohms and 20 picofarads, 60 cycle line, you're going to see a lot of voltage. John did it with a quarter amp fuse. I would do it with, let's say, a 10K resistor. If I put my voltohm milliammeter between my scope probe that I'm about to connect to something, and I think that something is grounded, and it's...
Repeater, timeout.
Once again, I'm taking the clip lead on the end of the scope probe, which we think is ground as far as the scope is concerned, and I'm about to connect it to something, and I put my voltohm milliammeter, my digital voltmeter between the two, and I measure some amount of voltage, 1, 2, 5 volts or whatever. And then I put a 10K resistor across that circuit. In other words, I'm shunting across the, I'm bringing the 10 megohm impedance of the digital voltmeter down to 10 kiloohms in my example. And if the 2 volts that I just saw goes to zero, I know it's only a stray capacitance. Because if it was a real connection with 2 volts on it, a 10K resistor would not short it out. So John does it with a fuse, I do it with a 10K resistor. It's the equivalent of using my old-fashioned triplet or Simpson. There they had 20,000 ohms per volt. If you're on the 3-volt scale, you're creating a 60,000 ohm resistance within the voltohm milliammeter itself. So these stray, really high impedance voltages that we measure nowadays with digital voltmeters, they didn't exist in the days when people used the voltohm milliammeter or the Dawson Bell movement, 50 microampere movement. That's where the 20,000 ohms per volt is coming from. It presents a real impedance, whereas that Dawn 10 megohm impedance of the modern-day digital voltmeter, it could get you into trouble once in a while. Let's see if Eric and John have got some further words on this. KE2EJ, K2RIW, and the Tech Man.
P2RW, K2J. Well, you're right about that, but now let's see. If I'm working on stuff where I've got real hot voltages and I'm working with line voltages, I tend not to want to work on a resistive pad like an ESD device. I mean, really the purpose of that is to eliminate static discharge that can be several thousands of volts. You want to drain that off. When you're working with real power, you can have real issues, even though there's a mega ohm of resistance there. And how much current is going to be passing through whatever it is that you're working on? I tend to, when I've worked on a lot of TV sets, and a lot of stuff today comes in plastic cases, which is, really a good insulator of many, many, many mega ohms between the stuff inside and everything outside. Don't want the kind of leakage current that's going to be harmful to you when you're working on stuff, especially if you're dealing with things that are directly powering your set. A non-transformer isolated TV set can get really nasty when you hook up your meter to the chassis and you actually hit a real ground somewhere. So that's the point of being thoroughly isolated. There are people that go a different way. The multi-mega ohm surfaces seems adequate to them. But I've worked on stuff where there ain't no way I'm going to do that because it's going to be hot. And I'm going to feel it. And I know that from experience. So there's a lot of different ways of thinking about this. And you're right about your traditional volt-ohm meter that's something like 25.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, we missed the last 10 or 15 seconds because of the timeout, Eric. Also, not only do I run full duplex when I'm running the TechNet, I also monitor the input frequency. And I heard K2CX attempt to sign in. I heard him on the input, but he's not coming through the machine. I'm guessing, Steve, you don't have your PL turned on. So when I turn it over to John, that'll give Steve some time to reestablish the PL, and we'll come back to him. KC2WGB, I bet you've seen some crazy voltages with a modern-day digital voltmeter that can really confuse you at times. Is that true, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And the PL is 136.5.
I know that our technical advisor knows that. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good. Yeah, it's a complicated subject, and if you do not pay attention and follow the same steps. When you're working with hot chassis or things that are above ground potential, you must be careful. And yeah, foam is very good for tracing down those kind of things. DTVMs are very similar to the oscilloscope. You put that clip lead in the wrong place, you're going to blow something up. So you must pay attention and use the right equipment. That's about it, Dick. It's not that difficult to do, but you just have to stay on course. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I own an old-fashioned Heathkit V3 or V7, I think it is, vacuum tube voltmeter. I remember one day I had the case off of it, and I wanted to measure the voltage that was on the 6SN7 vacuum tube that's inside. And I took the lead out of the front panel of the volt ohm, of the vacuum tube voltmeter, and I reached around to the back of the chassis, and I was about to make contact on the tube that's amplifying the voltage that's coming from that probe that's then going to go to the meter. And I said to myself, whoa, this ain't the right thing to do. If I got a reading, it's going to be crazy. I mean, that's way beyond bootstrapping, if you know what I mean. Let's see what Steve's going to say about all of the above. K2, Charlie X-ray. Hope your PL's turned on now, Steve. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, howdy, gents. I'm sure you can hear me now.
That's a big 10-4, good buddy. I heard you beautifully on the input before, but not coming through the machine. By some, was there a gremlin that turned off your PL in your case, Steve? Go ahead.
No, I was listening to the encode tone, which is different. So, hence my problem. Anyway, listening to your discussion of chassis grounds and the lack thereof, so that anybody that's listening that's not checked in and is wondering where a lot of this type of hardware was available was early cable radios, where they stopped using transformers. They took five tubes called the All-American Five. They came in an octal and octal, and as well as miniature variety. The miniatures were 12BE6, 12BH6, 12AV6, I think. 35W4 was the rectifier, and the 50C5. They were run in a series strain filament, which adds up to 117 volts. And the, let me make the tone go. those were the worst case. Many of the early ones had no polarized plugs on them. You could take the back off and disconnect the cord, or the cord had no polarity on it, so you could put it in either way in an outlet. Then the later ones came with a polarized cheetah cord. Anybody familiar with the old cheetah cords that were on television sets, where one pin was bigger than the other? And that was an attempt to soften it. But if you take that chassis and lay it down, those were the ones that could really, really get you. Just right off the line, you could have the hot side of the line on the chassis. All it takes is a simple turn around the plug, and that problem goes away. Isolation transformer on equipment you're working on is a matter of rule. When you work on that kind of gear, you just have to do it. Television sets were like that. And today, probably amateur operators don't run into this that much unless they have some old home brew equipment. But again, always paying attention and always checking first. If you see one side of that line going to ground, and I tell you, that's basically the way it is when you look at the inside of the chassis. You'll see right to ground, right to the chassis, goes one side of that line. Those are the areas where you need to be concerned about. You can get all sorts of other they call them sometimes step potentials or leakage on grounds. A lot of times it has to do with different lengths of grounds and current on the opposite phase and the like. But as someone else said, as long as it's not something that has a lot of current behind it, that's the little tickle you get when you would rub against the refrigerator and something ground, and it wasn't really anything there. It's just a sensation more than anything else. Back to net control. Say hello to the rest of the crew. K2CX, name's Steve.
Yeah, very fine, Steve. What Steve is telling us about is that the well-made radios of yore had a real transformer, a power transformer, developing the high voltage for the tubes. And to cheapen the radios later on, they became directly wired, no power transformer. The 110 volts was directly rectified. The filament string equaled 117 volts. And so one lead from the power cord went directly to the chassis. You could get away with that by mounting the whole piece of electronics in a plastic box with plastic knobs in the front, so that when the thing is used in the normal conditions, if the person didn't throw it in the bathtub of water, if you know what I mean, under normal conditions, from the outside you're safe. But the guy doing service has taken off the back panel, back cover, he may be taking the chassis out of the plastic box, and even television sets. I think the Admiral television set, the cheaper versions of around 1953, had series wiring and a directly grounded chassis. And with the plug in the wrong way, the chassis can become hot. So in order to save money, but it's cheapen some of these pieces of equipment, some corners were cut that definitely create some grief. For a short period of time, let me drop them. For a certain period of time, certain portions of New York City were DC wired, 110 volts DC. For instance, the majority of the engineering laboratory of Pratt Institute up until a few years ago had DC wiring locally generated. They had their own local power station with great big flywheels on those generators. So it was a fun thing to go look at as an engineer. I went to that particular school. So, the safest way to do it is an A minus B function with two separate scope probes. The next safest way to do it is to run everything with an isolation transformer in your particular shack. But even there, you've got to worry about if everything is floating. Is it floating with what potential? In theory, I think that the so-called floating should have, let me pick a number, a 10K or a 47K resistor, a good-sized resistor, from that floating network to what you know to be good earth ground, just to make sure you're not building up a static charge. So there's no one simple answer to all of this, as you can tell, Rich. But as you, let me drop.
This is DPZ with a comment.
Rich, as you hear us various people describing where voltages could be created and under which potentials you get those voltages, you're slowly getting a mental image of what the dangers are and what you're trying to avoid. So over to you, Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Where do I buy the Hubble device and approximately how much is it? K2RIW in the net, WB2GXM.
Darn good question. Eric, you got an answer to that? And I'm going to go over to Eric and then John in that order. Eric first.
Well, what are you looking for? A ground fault indicator? You can buy them, at any Home Depot or Lowe's, that kind of thing.
Yeah, but he's asking the one that John... I'm going to go over to John. John, you described a device that you can plug into the wall socket without necessarily rewiring the wall socket. And Hubble makes this thing that gives you a GFI-like function. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead.
KC2WGB for comment.
KC2WGB. Okay, any electrical supply store, they have them, and Hubble is very good, rugged, and they use them on portable generators. If they're grounded properly, they'll work. And as far as cost, last time I think they were about $45. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
82 AMZ.
I thank you, John. And 82 AMZ. Where am I at? Oh, yeah, there you are. Michelle. Michael? I'm going to call you Michael. Michelle. You've got it. KD2AMZ, K2RIW.
Pronounced Mihail, like Gorbachev, but Mike works very well. Granger has them. Construction supply houses have them as a standard construction item used on every construction site, so they're very, very easy to get.
And you've used them, Michelle, and you're happy with them? And in some cases, do you have to run a real long lead to find something that you know to be a good earth ground? Over to you, Michelle. And Mikhail.
Mike works much better. We always have grounds, make sure, because they're new installations and construction sites. So we just make sure it's ground. But this device, it's a simple series plug-in device. It's available at Granger's. It's available at any construction supply house. It is a standard construction item used on all construction sites.
Do you have a current price on it?
$45, something in that range.
The $45 version, is that rated for either 15 or 20 amperes? Go ahead.
I think it was like 20 amps, because we got to use some relatively large machines on the construction site, but... yeah, I guess it could come in a 15 and a 20 amp version, but yeah, just go to Granger.com, Granger sells them.
Okay, you've asked a darn good question, Rich, which has no simple answer. Step by step, we have to have a mental image of what the wiring of the whole circuit looks like. It starts off with, in some cases, 13 kilovolt line coming down your as the distribution high voltage that goes into the pole pig transformer primary. The secondary of the pole pig transformer, across its outer leads, has got something like 240 volts with a center tap. So three wires from that pole pig transformer come into your house. A 240 volt secondary winding with a center tap that's the so-called neutral. And that's the unshielded wire coming into your house. The other red and black wire, plus that unshielded wire, all go into your fuse panel. Not with modern day houses, you've got a real grounding rod right outside the house at the place of entry, and that grounding lead, which I think is a piece of 8 gauge wire, That also goes to your fuse panel and your so-called neutral and earth are all wired together at the chassis of your fuse panel. It's the one place where they usually come together. And then after that, let me drop. In the worst case, you might have some piece of electronics with a good-sized transformer in it, with a large local magnetic field at 60 cycles coming out of the transformer, and the so-called neutral wire of your wiring to your socket in your shack. That wire could be picking up voltage because of the Faraday effect. I think it's Faraday's law, yes. A local magnetic field could be inducing voltage across that wire that you think is neutral, that has been brought to so-called the common grounding point, the earthing point at the fuse panel. But at your shack, by the time it gets there, various voltages could appear on that wire because of local magnetic fields. And if there's some kind of error in the circuitry where there isn't a GFI and some kind of miswired piece of electronics is pouring current into the so-called neutral, the neutral by IR drop can be developing a voltage with reference to the earthing back at the circuit panel, as you can tell. So life is not simple. And the worst case situation, let me drop.
Quick comment, Dick.
Okay, John, recognize the worst case situation I know of is that the house across the street from me, the telephone pole had been hit by a car and sheared. And when they put things back together, the grounding lead from the butt plate at the bottom of the reinstalled telephone pole, utility pole, that grounding lead was not attached to the pole pig transformer control to its case. Therefore, the only grounding of that secondary wiring of that pole pig transformer was by way of the house wiring of the houses that it went to. And the next time that a car hit that exact same telephone pole, the 13 kilovolts now appeared across hit the fuse panel of that particular house. It created a fire in the house. Thank goodness they discovered the fire before the house burned down. So if you measure the current, if you put a clamp-on ammeter on what you think is a grounding lead in your house, in other words, your fuse panel usually has a piece of heavy gauge wire going to a water pipe, copper water pipe. If you still have copper water pipe, and you put your clamp ammeter across that lead, and you measure any significant amount of current, that's something that definitely should be investigated. KC2WGB, K2IW and TechNet. I'll give you more information on the next go around. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, very true. Also, Dick, the neutral not supposed to be carrying current, basically, if everything is balanced. So if you have an unbalanced load, you're going to have current flowing through that neutral. It could be considerable. Now, if you have resistive joints, you're going to be developing voltage drops across all of them, and that can be an issue at times. But just, you know, another thing to look out for. That's why it's good to have everything tightened up.
Some comments.
That sounds like Vito. Go right ahead. I think it's Vito. Go right ahead. Give us your call letters and your name to be double sure.
K2ZJE with some comments. Ed.
Go right ahead, Ed.
Getting all. It's a very complicated subject. There can be all kinds of miscellaneous voltages on round pin, assuming it is wired. The neutral pin, assuming it is correctly wired to the right side of the outlet. I'll give you one example. In one of the buildings that I used to service, an electrician pulled in about 100 feet of cable into a conduit. He energized the input side, and on the output side, he measured voltage on the neutral and voltage on the ground, and he said to himself, I must have frayed a wire someplace where I pulled it in. I stopped him right away. I said, what we have here is capacitive coupling to the wires, hook up a load, and then take your measurements. He was all ready to pull out 100 feet of cable. The thing, if you're going to have a service bench, like in your basement, I would put there a dedicated outlet that did not have any ground loops. I'm going to break for a minute. A dedicated outlet, you wire it preferably with conduit from the panel. You pull in three wires. You pull in your green ground, which is picking up no other outlets. You pull in your black and your white wires. You put that to your outlet. The metal box picks up ground from the conduit. The ground pin in the outlet is connected to the green wire. It is not in any way connected to the box, and of course your other two wires, your white and your black. Usually those outlets are marked being dedicated using orange hardware. Over.
Yeah, the actual socket that you're about to wire usually has a brass nut, a brass screw, and a stainless steel looking screw. And I guess there's a standard there as to where white and black goes. White is usually considered to be neutral. Black is usually considered to be hot. So black is going to go to the narrow blade, and white is going to go to the broad blade. And whether or not which one is the orange screw and which one is the white screw, you're going to bring me up to speed on that one, Ed. K2GJE, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2GJE, back. Modern outlets have three screws. There is a green screw. There is a brass screw for the black wire. And there is a, like a cat-plated screw for the white wire. Over.
Net, tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Yeah, thank you, Ed. Now we got that straight. So the brass is the black, and the white is the... So white goes to the white screw, so to speak. Brass goes to the black screw. Green, of course, is the so-called ground lead, earthing lead, on these modern-day sockets. And be advised that the Radio Shack, among other people, would sell this yellow plug-like thing that when you threw at the wiring, you plugged it in, and it had red and green lights, and if the green lights lit and none of the red lights lit, then in theory, the socket was wired correctly. In theory. If you properly transposed all three wires in a clockwise manner, that plug-in device from Radio Shack will light the green light and not light the red light. So it's a necessary but not sufficient test. It's a good test most of the time. But in the worst situation, it could give you a misdetect of miswiring. And the only way you would know that would be to take a... there's a kind of a voltage probe that's used on Christmas lights. You hold this thing in your hand. It's got a field effect transistor in the front end. You press the little button on it. And when you hold the probe on the end of this handheld device near the two wires of your series wired... Christmas tree lights. Let me drop. And it picks up the capacitive coupling of a wire that's got 110 volts on it, and it will light its light. And the other lead that if you jump across a light bulb that's an open circuit and the voltage is no longer there, it'll go out. So this handheld device allows you to do very rapid wiring of Christmas tree light, or very rapid troubleshooting of series Christmas tree lights to find the bad bulb, because replacing the bulbs one at a time and then going back to the original bulb, if you only have one bulb that's out, you'll eventually find the bad bulb. If two bulbs are out, you're never going to find it. And on top of that, plugging and unplugging bulbs is a pain. So to use this device that you just hold near the wiring is a hell of a lot faster. Well, you take that particular device and you hold it near the socket. You hold it near the narrow